benefits a whole community versus taking it from one person and giving it to another person. Some would argue, well, you know, that is helping the community, but I call that robbery when you do something like that.
Yes, that's true. And most service industries tend not to be producing oriented. I think that's another reason why our country is heading down instead of up as far as production and wages and economic growth.
Absolutely, yeah. We've been going down about 1% per year since 1973, so we're quite a ways down. The average family now is being taxed four times as much as the average family was back in 1950. So it's no wonder that people are having a very difficult time making ends meet and keeping a roof over their heads.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, folks, the call-in number is 464-8295. We had quite a few people weigh in on this business of whether government should forcibly redistribute the wealth. And you're certainly welcome to call in and voice your opinions on that. And as I say, I think the problem, as Tom was saying, that we do have institutionalized greed that is running our government. Our government is corrupt. The monetary system is corrupt. So it just means that there are many people we're all being exploited from this kind of system. So it's very difficult to get an idea of what kind of monetary system and what kind of society we'd have if we were not being exploited on an ongoing, continual, daily basis. Tom's quite correct in talking about being exploited on a daily basis. So we have living in a very corrupt society. And what to do about it? I don't think that forcibly redistributing the wealth is the way to go, but good evening, caller. You're on the airwaves.
Hi, this is Paul in Capitola.
Yes.
I just wanted to make some comments about the caller that wanted to redistribute the wealth. I think that was really the wrong way to approach the problem. Since 1913, we've lost 95% of the value of the dollar, right?
Correct.
And I've been reading about, like, you know, fiat currency lately, and it was like commented, it's like adding water to milk. And that means we have 95% water and 5% milk. And when do we stop calling it, like, milk and start calling it water? You know, people chasing wealth, calling it 30 million. It's 30 million, 60 trillion in debt, you know? Or, you know, no, 44 trillion, sorry. This is the last time I heard. And I was, you know, looking around on the internet, and I found something called the American Liberty Dollar. I don't know exactly if it's, I don't know if it's perfect yet, but it's a silver-backed currency. I don't know. They use $10 to an ounce. I know it's slightly over, but it's so they can keep the coin in circulation. But it's something to look into, and it follows the UCC. It follows the Universal Commercial Code. And it's been looked into by the Treasury. It's okay. So just wanted to mention that. And I'm also going to look into cracking the code. Haven't quite got my copy yet, but looking forward to that.
Well, it certainly it sounds like a very fascinating book. And as Tom was saying, it's offers a key to understanding what's the actual mechanism of the exploitation going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's just if we don't stop... If we don't look at what the dollar means and what it is, it's a dead instrument. If me and you make a deal and I build a fence in your yard and you pay me for it, someone else is standing there between us, a user.
That's right.
Using us, and that's simply not okay with me.
Absolutely.
Anyway,
well,
that's my main comment. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Well, folks, I'm at the end of my program here. I thank you all for listening. I'll be back here next Monday at 7 o'clock. Thank you very much for listening.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being because we have with us on the line from Sudbury in Ontario, Canada, Don Scott. Don, how are you tonight?
I'm well, thank you, Dr. Stan.
And I appreciate you staying up. I know it's late back there in the eastern part of Canada, but I always enjoy having you with us so very, very much. And we're going to be talking about, well, we're going to be talking about SARS. We're going to be talking about the neurodegenerative diseases and the effort by the group there that Don heads to try to get to the bottom of those. And, well, as many things as we possibly can during this hour. So why don't you just start at the very beginning? Why don't you tell us a little bit about the project you have to find out the relationship between the neurodegenerative diseases and perhaps some of these organisms, these infectious organisms that you talk about?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Dr. Stan. We have launched, and by we, I refer to our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, which is a not-for-profit group dedicated to researching the neurosystemic degenerative diseases. Now, these are the diseases of which it is said there's no known cause, there's no known cure, and which are characterized by cells in certain parts of the brain and body falling apart from the inside out. Something affects the cells, and after a period of time, the cell gives up, ruptures, and dumps its contents into the blood and plasma, and leaves behind a dead cell or scar.
Now, we're really talking about diseases like Alzheimer's, ALS, Parkinson's disease.
Yes, indeed. They are some of the principal ones. Alzheimer's, of course, where almost every cell in the brain is at risk. And what happens with them, of course, the cells rupture, their membrane walls lose their integrity. They open up and they dump all their contents into puddles and pools. And before they reach that stage, however, the neuronal cells, the brain cells, they fill up with a fibrillary tangle, a growth of fibers that has no clear purpose evident to us, and which take their substance from the cell that they're in and ultimately kill it. And beginning, as you mentioned, with the Alzheimer's, which I've just discussed, the amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, really the same disease, because what happens is the cells in the glia, which surround the motor neurons in the spinal column, those cells, which were supposed to manufacture cholesterol and secrete it into the motor neurons so that the synapses, the little gaps that are in existence between the upper motor neurons and the alpha motor neurons and the alpha motor neurons and the muscles, those gaps, they will fall apart if they're not replenished and renewed by cholesterol. And if the glia cells alongside them are infected with a mycoplasma fermentans, then they don't produce the cholesterol needed, and the synapses are not maintained, and the message from the cortex of the brain to the muscles is lost, and the muscles atrophy, and the individual slowly dies. So right from Alzheimer's and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis down through multiple sclerosis and Huntington's and Parkinson's and Crohn's colitis and diabetes type 1, all of these diseases are characterized by this process of cellular degeneration.
Well, now it's your contention that this is related to a mycoplasma infection that is really responsible for this, or at least for many of the degenerative diseases, and that in certain instances, such as Huntington's, there is a genetic predisposition, and that would be true probably in, at least in some cases of diabetes. Would that be a fair assumption?
Yes, the mycoplasma, which is a particle of a bacterial DNA, exists after its kind of parent bacterium dies. That particle says, I want to keep living. And so it looks for a cell that'll let it in. Now that is the genetic predisposition.
So now, how does a mycoplasm differ from a virus? Because certainly a virus is simply a part of a DNA, certainly just a few molecules that has to inhabit the cell to live. So how does then a mycoplasm differ from a virus?
Well, the virus is a more deliberate creation. The virus is, as you point out, particles of the bacterial DNA, but they are particles which have a protective protein coat. When they are liberated from the original bacterium from which they come, they self-assemble from the environment proteins in the form of a kind of protective cover around themselves. So viruses have been around, it seems that they are a more ancient organism than the mycoplasma. The mycoplasma occurred very, very rarely in history, but it did occur. But over the past 60 years, the mycoplasma has increased dramatically. And we attribute that to the biological weapons research that has gone on since the mid-1940s. In fact, that kind of ties in with the West Nile virus, because way back in 1943, if you can imagine it, Dr. Joseph Smedell, a medical researcher with the Walter Reed Military Hospital in Washington, D.C., he was experimenting with the West Nile virus, and he was experimenting to find out, can this virus be carried by mosquitoes? Now that was research being done way back in 1943 in the United States.
Now, was any experiments being done? We know that America started, the United States started doing experiments on the mycoplasma following the Second World War. Have you ever heard anything about the Germans being involved in mycoplasma research during the Second World War or before? And I'm speaking now of the Nazi scientists.
Yes, we've seen allusions to some of their work. Dr. Mendel and his band of lunatics, really, were doing a variety of research. We haven't paid a great deal of attention to it because a lot of their documentation was, of course, destroyed with the Allied occupation. But we do know that some of their key researchers were recruited by the United States after the Second World War, were put into American military uniforms, and were secretly transported to the United States, where they were given employment in American research facilities of various kinds. Now that, of course, was Project Paperclip and a couple of other the illegal immigrant programs that the United States conducted. So there was work going on by the Germans. There was a lot of work going on by the Japanese, of course. Their notorious Unit 731, which was supposed to be a unit devoted to the creation of safe water supplies, was really a front for the research into biological weaponry. And they, too, provided the United States at war end with their researchers. Now, they couldn't take a whole bunch of Japanese and throw them into U.S. Army uniforms and fly them over into the States. They'd be a bit too conspicuous. So what they did, of course, was they recruited General Ishishiro, who was head of the Japanese research program, and he and all of his fellows were spared prosecution for the very evil testing that they had done on Allied prisoners of war, and General MacArthur approved this. I mean, there's no limits to the extent to which some of our heroes, as it were, went along with some of this evil. Shiro, in agreement for being let out of any prosecution for war crimes, he agreed to share all of his secrets and the secrets of the people who had worked with him. And many of them actually became quite active participants in American biological warfare work, staying on, of course, in Japan. And from their work, it's very evident that the test site in New Guinea, which they established in 1942, and which seems to have been the site where they were testing the Vizsla virus, cofactor in the creation of the AIDS disease etiological agents. That was learned from Dr. Ishishiro and the Japanese. And what all we learned from the Germans, we don't know. But it all added up that in 1945, the British, American, Canadian research of World War II was greatly complemented by work from the German researchers and the Japanese researchers. And this, of course, was in competition with the research that was being done in Russia with the same disease agents, working with anthrax, working with brucellosis, and so on.
As biological warfare agents, of course.
All of this work designed to find ways of using biological agents to kill or disable so-called enemies.
Now, of course, they did then somehow genetically modify the mycoplasm agent so that it would be much more aggressive, because certainly mycoplasm had been around before, but they somehow modified this and made it so it would really invade the body and begin to destroy organisms, organs, I should say?
Yes, it was kind of a happenstance sort of research initially, because when in 1946, Dr. George Merck, who was in charge of the American research, he reported to the Secretary of Defense that the Allied researchers had managed to isolate what they called the disease active principle from the original bacteria in crystalline form.
Now, this was the brucellosis, the bacteria, is that right?
That was the principal one. Now, there were a number of others, but certainly the brucellosis bacterium was the grandfather of most of the really significant research, the various species of the Brucella, the Brucella sui, which comes from pigs, Brucella malatensis, which comes from cattle or goats, the Brucella canis, which of course is related to dogs, all of these different species, but especially one from cattle called Brucella abortus. They were the principal sources of disease, which were isolated from the bacteria. And you see the marvel of this, Dr. Stan, for biological research. They take the disease active principle. They take that part of the DNA which does the damage to the host that it inhabits, and they render it into a crystalline form, and they throw away all the rest of the bacteria. And so they can give a person a bacterial disease, and there will be no trace of the bacteria in that individual. So they're able to say, well, this person isn't really sick, it's all in his head. Just look, here's the blood test, there's no bacterium and there's no virus, and yet he's letting on, he's got headaches, he's letting on, he's got stomach aches, he's letting on, he's got weakness in the muscles and extreme fatigue. And they were able to cloak their research by saying that the diseases that were presenting were largely the product of the individual's inability to cope.
Now you're, of course, suggesting this is what chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, and this whole spectrum of diseases is.
Yes, they used it everywhere they could, including the awful, awful stories that they circulated about victims of chronic fatigue. People with chronic fatigue, plain and simply, have chronic brucellosis.
Well, of course, how can that be proven?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Dr. Stan, because genetic sequencing, it is coming to our aid more and more. And if one studies the genetic sequence of the bacteria called Brucella abortus, and when you read the special virus cancer programs project, their program progress report number 15, you see how important that is.
You know, for a listener who really doesn't know what the special virus cancer program is, this was a program that was authorized by our government, financed by a part of this war against cancer that began with Lyndon Johnson and then picked up by Richard Nixon, and they put out these various reports of 1 through 15 of these special cancer virus reports. My understanding is that somewhere along the line, why the head of the CIA ordered them all destroyed up through 8 and 9. Incidentally, I was trying to find out where in your book dealing with this tragic Skull Valley incident. Incidentally, we carry that book. Where in that book, I remember reading there that the head of the CIA had authorized or ordered, I think it was Sidney Gottlieb, to destroy all the copies of that. Am I mistaken, or is that did that actually happen?
Oh, yes, that very clearly happened. Richard Helms was the guy who told Gottlieb to get to work, gather them all up and shred them.
Was that Jolly, or is that Gottlieb?
Gottlieb, yeah.
All right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment with John Scott. Do you recall whereabouts in your book just about that story is told? Because I remember reading it, and I've gone through it half a dozen other times and never found it.
Sure. We're going into a break, I gather.
We're only going in for about just a moment for you and I, listeners up in the Great Northwest, of course, are going to have a four-minute break. Well, I'll talk to you later about that. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Okay, thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Don Scott. And Don, you pick up this story from there.
Yeah, okay. Just before we get on to Richard Helms and his post-Watergate order to destroy the special virus cancer program, progress reports 8 and 9, and the ones previous to it, I did want to follow up on the link between the bacteria Brucella and the mycoplasma. The genetic sequence, that is to say that pattern of genes that characterizes living organisms, the pattern for the Brucella abortus is identical. A very good section of the bacterium DNA is identical to the sequence in the Mycoplasma fermentans. Mycoplasma fermentans is very obviously derived from Brucella abortus, and it's isolated from the Brucella abortus in crystalline form. And because it's in crystalline form, it can be reduced to a very, very fine powder, and it can be added to another powder simply to extend its volume. And this can be used to contaminate mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes, when they're contaminated, can be put into transport trailer trucks and taken to a community in the middle of the night, and the sides of it open, and a fan will waft the mosquitoes out into the environment, and the truck drive away. And this is actually all now part of history.
Now, of course, I think for our listeners out there who say, gee, that could never happen in America, they wouldn't be experimenting on the American people. You do have the documentation on that, don't you?
Yes, we do have, because, of course, Canada, an ally of the United States, and one that the present American administration doesn't seem to appreciate very much. But anyway, the Canadians were asked by the American researchers to really give them a hand up in this whole research project of disseminating in crystalline form the disease active principle from various disease agents such as the Brucella abortus. And Canada agreed to do this, and they said, what is it you'd like us to do? And the Americans asked us to breed mosquitoes. So Canada established the Dominion Parasite Laboratory in Belleville, Ontario, Canada. And in that laboratory, they bred 100 million mosquitoes a month. And then they transferred these 100 million mosquitoes to Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. And at Queen's University, the biology department contaminated the mosquitoes with the various disease agents, including all those derived from the Brucella. And when they had their millions of infected mosquitoes, they transferred these to the Canadian military, who shared them with the American military and the British military, and now we've learned the Australian military. And the militaries, in turn, went out in their own countries, and in any country they occupied, like Britain had access to South Africa, and they did a lot of testing there, and they let these infected mosquitoes out by various ways, as they say, transport trailers specially adapted to carrying the mosquitoes were one type. They also had balloons that they let out of airplanes, which after they descended to within a certain distance of the ground, opened up and the mosquitoes were allowed to blow free. This was going on, and we know it now very, very happily, because these people who are geniuses in many ways are also stupid in other ways. What had happened here in Canada, the military was doing all this work, and some person in the Canadian military was transferring records of their experimental activities to the Canadian National Research Council, because he said, well, this is research, and it's biological, so they will be interested, and he sent it off to them. And then after the Watergate scandal, when everybody in Washington was investigating everybody else for something, and Richard Helms said to Sidney Gottlieb, look, Sid, get all the records of all of these activities which were designed to disable or kill people in third world countries, gather those documents up and shred them and burn them, including the documents for the Special Virus Cancer Program.
Now, actually, somebody wrote a book and actually had that in there. Do you recall which book that was? I remember the reference, but I...
Yeah, there's John Bryden's book. He's a Canadian, called Deadly Allies. He has quite a good account of much of this. And he based his work on the work of other people, too, of course, that had come out here and there and everywhere. But when the records in the National Research Council were sitting there, and when the order came out to shred all the records, the Canadian military basically is supposed to have shredded theirs. I dare say, like every other military, they actually have kept documents in deep secret. Nobody passed the word to the National Research Council that these records were to be shredded. So they're sitting there today in Ottawa, Canada, and they are available to researchers, and within a few weeks, a local Ottawa doctor and I are going to visit and review these documents, which are available for researchers to look at, but they won't let us photocopy them, and they won't let us make notes of them. But we will be able to see the original material and read over parts of it and that sort of thing.
Well, of course, now Dr. Len Horowitz had found Report 8 and Report 9, and you have some of the other reports now because of your help. Some of these got into major university libraries, and people have found them, and so you've actually collected them. And there's no question at all that these incredible macabre things were going on behind the scenes, all part of this idea, well, we need to find out what the enemy might be able to do so we can defend against it. So we've got to find out what they can do about how they could spread the disease. And all of this was supposedly to defend the American people. And what they did was unleash this. We know that they unleashed a lot of the mycoplasm in Huntsville, Texas, and I'm sure you're acquainted with that story. They released them here in the prison there. And, of course, it infected the whole town of Huntsville.
Yes, indeed. We had some very excellent work out of Huntsville by a couple of lady researchers down there, who one lady... whose son developed a juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And, of course, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis is very closely linked to the mycoplasma and lymphadenopathy and the other disease presentations that the mycoplasma produces. So we've got a very, very solid record of scientific activity and testing.
And I think what was so interesting is that everybody in the prison board denied this, and the government denied it, and then these ladies actually found the contracts that had been signed between the prison and the government to carry out the macabre experiments. And, of course, there was a couple of people died under very mysterious circumstances there, which is one reason Dr. Garth Nicholson left his position, a tenured position, as with two or three professorships at MD Anderson Clinic, because the people who were dying were his students, and of course they were looking into what happened in Huntsville. And so Garth came to California, and this is an incredible, incredible story. Would they really kill people who were looking into this in America? Well, we'll be back for that in just a moment here with our special guest this evening, Donald Scott. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Don Scott. We're talking about, of course, the fact that they have created all sorts of diseases, and of course there's all sorts of evidences in this special cancer virus reports. That's why they had to shred them all, and that was, what, about 1973?
Yeah, 73, 74.
All right, fine. But of course they didn't do a very good job of it, and Don has them, I have copies. People all across the country have done the research on this, now have copies of these various reports, and of course you need to understand that these things are going on today. Over 800,000 Americans have an entirely new disease. It's called chronic fatigue syndrome. Those of you who have not yet read Hillary Johnson's Osler's Web, we actually have copies of that now, and it is available through Radio Liberty. One of the most fascinating books. It's a story of chronic fatigue and how the government worked at every means, did everything possible to keep in the investigation to find out what this was. And of course, people suffering from this disease got Congress to authorize money to find out what it was. The Centers for Disease Control intentionally would either not put the money out for studies or would give it to people to study the psychiatric aspect of this. Everything was done to actually attack the people who were trying to find out what was going on, and of course to belittle anyone who said that now we had hundreds of thousands of Americans with a chronic incurable disease that had destroyed their lives. So pick up the story from there.
Yes, well, June the 9th, 1969 meeting between Dr. Donald MacArthur of the Pentagon and 12 congressmen of the United States Congress. In that meeting, Dr. MacArthur told the congressman, he said, you know, we're working on two main branches of biological weapons. Now, one branch is developing a disease agent which will be disabling, and the other is developing a lethal agent. And, of course, the lethal agent was designed for the third world countries, basically. A document that you have in inventory, I know, and you make available to your listeners is Henry Kissinger's NSAM 200, where Kissinger tells Richard Nixon and the defense establishment that the growth of the population in the world, especially in the third world countries, is a bigger threat to United States national security than is the atom bomb, and that something has to be done about the burgeoning population. Now, we know, actually, that this was after the fact, that they had actually developed their agents and they were actually using them, but in order to legitimize it all, as the Watergate was shredding the Nixon administration, there was this effort to get a kind of post-criminal activities legitimized by getting everybody on side, the congressman and all the rest of it.
Now, that's National Security Study Memorandum 200. It was put out in 1974 under the direction of Henry Kissinger. That is available through Radio Liberty, as is Hillary Johnson's wonderful, wonderful book, Osler's Web. And if you want to know more about those, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Hillary Johnson's book reads like a mystery novel. The only trouble is it's really true. And, of course, NSSM 200 was classified for many years because they didn't want the American people to know we had a genocidal program towards third world countries, and the purpose was we didn't want their population to increase because, of course, then they would want to use their own natural resources. Then they might become industrialized, and they might compete with us. So we had to say, oh, well, we were concerned about poverty. We were concerned about communism. Oh, we had all these excuses. What we really wanted to do was kill off a large part of their population.
And you not only carry Osler's Web, but as you mentioned, you do carry the book by my son and I, Skull Valley.
I think that is an amazing book, and we do carry that. What is it called? The Amazing...
It is called The Extremely Unfortunate Skull Valley Incident. And those are words from the June 9th, 1969 hearings, when MacArthur was explaining to the congressman what had gone wrong when they were testing one of their disease agents out in Utah, and the stuff got out of hand and killed between 4,000 and 8,000 sheep. But anyway, all of that history is there, and it's very hard to dig out. But that's why, at this point in time, our foundation has established a Sudbury study. We say, all right, we've got all kinds of evidence. My goodness, anybody who reads the evidence will know that some of the great lies of all time are being foisted off on people. For example, if anybody takes the time to look up HIV in a medical dictionary, and they see human immunodeficiency virus, and then they see will see a colon, and they will see what it actually is. It's HTLV3. That is to say, it is a particle of the human T-cell leukemia virus. It's not an immune deficiency virus. It's a human T-cell leukemia virus adapted from the Vizsla virus of sheep. And yet the myth that HIV causes AIDS is pushed off onto the public, including doctors who should know better and who, I guess, never consult their medical dictionaries. But anyway, against all that background...
Well, now, of course, the people, though, who have AIDS do have HIV positive.
But certainly
they have a mycoplasm. Almost all of them have a mycoplasm infection.
Yeah, there are the cofactors. Right. And the French researcher, Luc Montagnier, is the most honest one of the whole works. He says there's a cofactors. He says there's the HTLV3, which is the Vizsla virus, and there's a cofactor, the mycoplasma, which acts to lower the defense of the body and make the way for the opportunistic diseases such as cancer and diarrhea and senility and all the rest of it to bring on all the characteristics of AIDS. But you see, the story that HIV exists is, of course, baloney. It's actually HTLV3, and there are people who have died of AIDS who don't have HIV, and there are people who have HIV who don't die of AIDS, but it's a story that's made up by Robert Gallo and his researchers and foisted off onto the world, and politicians and medical professionals go along with it, because if they don't, they lose all their research grants and so on. However, back to the Sudbury study, we in our foundation urge all people with Alzheimer's in their family, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, chronic fatigue syndrome, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Huntington's, diabetes type 1, schizophrenia, bipolar depression. All of these diseases our research has linked to the mycoplasma. And we are therefore saying, as of May 1st this year, for 1 year, we're conducting a study based upon actual living human beings who will feed back to us their symptoms and their stories in anecdotal form, from which we can draw confirmation of the reality that these are all diseases which have as either the main factor or as a cofactor the mycoplasma. Now, most of them will have mycoplasma frumentans, but there's mycoplasma pneumoniae and mycoplasma penetrans and the rest of it. Don't worry about those scientific details. If you or a family member or friend has one of these terrible diseases, and you want to help us replace all of the mythology with solid, reproducible data, then send your name and address to us. No money necessary. Send your name and address to study, 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 box 133, station D as in Bob, Sudbury, Canada, P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4, N as in Norman 5, and tell us which disease you are particularly concerned with, and we will include you in our study, and we will draw together for the first time ever a solid statistical base of data on these diseases, and which will be able then to refute the claim of the NIH and the CDC and all the doctors you run into that there's no known cause and no known cure.
Now, if you're going to draw blood samples, how are you going to know whether the people have a mycoplasma?
Well, there is one test that involves a blood sample, and it'll be pretty optional, but it's one that is conducted by Dr. Les Simpson in New Zealand, and it only takes 4 or 5 drops of blood, and he is then able to demonstrate what the shape the blood cells are in. But most of the tests are actually very straightforward and very easy and non-invasive. We have 11 such tests, and we have them prioritized so that you can get the first 5 or 6 or 7 of them if you wish, and give us the results and help us establish this picture, because we know from our research, and we're totally satisfied, that Parkinson's and Huntington's and Alzheimer's and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, they're all related. They are all tied to the fact that a bacterial particle called the mycoplasma accesses certain cells that'll let it in, genetically appropriate, and that after a period of time doing nobody any harm, if that particle is roused into activity, such as the Pope's fall in the bathtub, or Ronald Reagan's bullet wound, or Michael J. Fox's near-death experience when he was filming Back to the Future movie, these traumas trigger the mycoplasma into going to work. And when it goes to work, what it does, it starts pulling preformed sterols out of its host, and it incorporates these sterols into itself, and it manufactures the useless protein fibers that are characteristic of all of these diseases and are usually referred to as scrapie-like fibers. And when we get all of this as solid data, you see, I tried to get it from the Canadian government's Department of Health, and 3 different ministers of health tried to help me on this, or at least they let on they did, and they finally sent me a summary that they had, which was drawn from magazine articles and anecdotal comments here and there and everywhere. They just don't have the solid data. And this is, you mentioned how money appropriated by Congress had been given to the Centers for Disease Control to study chronic fatigue syndrome, and that money was misappropriated. The reason it was misappropriated is that the Centers for Disease Control already knows where chronic fatigue comes from. And they can't spend money to research it, because if they do, they have to publish the results, and the results will show that the U.S. government, with the help of their allies, developed it.
All right, fine. Well, we're so if you'd like to help Don, you get in touch with him. And, of course, you have your name and address to study, Post Office Box 133, Station B, Sudbury. That's Ontario, Canada. And that's P3E4N5. Well, we're just about, we've only got a few minutes, relatively few minutes. I'd like to get your thought on the SARS epidemic. Certainly this appears to be an entirely new organism. We're told it's a coronavirus, but all of the evidence we've heard is it's an entirely new type of virus. Never been seen this type of coronavirus before. Have you been able to find anything that you think is valid as far as this is concerned?
Yes, well, first of all, what we did was looked at the acronym SARS, S-A-R-S, and we realized that S for severe, that's an adjective, drop it, doesn't mean anything. And A, acute, that's an adjective, drop it, doesn't mean anything. The last two letters, RS, respiratory syndrome, that takes us right smack back. Not to the coronavirus, which is there's possibly a factor, but there's something else there I'll mention in a minute. But you go to Dr. Shai-Ching Lo and his patent, when he patented the pathogenic mycoplasma. And on page 120 of this U.S. government document, the patent document, he lists the diseases which are associated with the mycoplasma. And one of the diseases is respiratory distress syndrome. Well, respiratory syndrome, respiratory distress syndrome, a good starting point. Now, how about the claim that, this isn't that particular respiratory syndrome, this is another respiratory syndrome, this is a severe respiratory syndrome, this is an acute respiratory syndrome. Those are just words to lead you off the track. They are respiratory syndromes, and the mycoplasma runs a very, very good chance of being involved. Now, whether it's fermentans or whether it's pneumoniae or what, we're not sure. But we do know this, that the coronavirus, which they say is involved, was initially found in just 40% of the victims. And now the averaging out of victims that have the coronavirus present has reduced it to 14%. Only 14 out of 100 who have the disease present with the coronavirus. So there's something awful fishy there. And we think it's based upon the fact that the coronavirus is a big virus and is very pliable. And it has great ability to access human beings as well as pigs and chickens. And it has been used in a number of research activities. It's been going on for quite some time. For example, they were taking the coronavirus and they were spiking it with certain kinds of disease agents to treat brain tumors with.
In other words, they were doing genetic experimentation or genetic engineering with the coronavirus, is what you're saying.
Yes, indeed. Some of them using it to kill brain tumors, and other experiments where they took the coronavirus and they tacked onto it the defective, well, actually a healthy gene that is missing in people who have cystic fibrosis. They take the coronavirus, they splice in a healthy gene. They expose the coronavirus to the CF victim. He breathes it in. The body kills off the coronavirus, and the gene finds its way to the areas where it's needed to handle the accumulating mucus in the lungs and so on. And this treatment for cystic fibrosis has worked. Unfortunately, it only works in a very small percentage of cases, but the thing is that the coronavirus is probably misleading. And the hopes of finding the real agent, which is probably one of the mycoplasmas, is questionable. And as I say, the Shai-Ching Lo patent, with its references to the respiratory distress syndrome, that's far more important than the coronavirus is. And another thing that we have been focusing our attention on, in Toronto, the people who were developing the disease were 60% medical personnel. In other words, a whole bunch of people get exposed to the disease agent. But those who get the disease were mainly those in the medical profession who, of course, are exposed to the disease because others who are carrying it come into the hospital. And why is it that the medical personnel are the ones who suffer the greatest from it? And we think that has something to do with the mandated vaccines that the medical professionals have to take. Something predisposes them to vulnerability. And we're continuing our studies on this. We've got an awful lot of material. And as we find particularly important things, we share it with other people in our organization who do research with us and for us. And we do think that there's much more to the SARS than meets the eye. We also are very firmly convinced that the World Health Organization's travel advisory, where they said to the world, don't visit Toronto, Canada, that was mainly a political, economic activity. It really had nothing to do with the seriousness of the outbreak. I mean, there had been 16 people at that point had died in Toronto. There are more people dying from traffic accidents and AIDS and all kinds of other things. Why did the World Health Organization do this? We think it was mainly political and economic because the government of Canada would not support the American invasion of Iraq. It was punitive, and it had nothing to do with the science of the disease. If you examine the record that over 6 months, about 500 people have died of SARS, just imagine in the 2 hours of your program tonight, 500 people will have died of AIDS. And where's the World Health Organization in that crisis? They're nowhere to be seen, really. They've got a guy, Stephen Lewis, hitchhiking around Africa, handing out condoms to black men. And that's supposed to be the World Health Organization's response to AIDS in the third world. It's absolutely criminal. So the prospects that the biological warfare research and population control are still going on, there are still people working at it very diligently and very successfully, is still with us. And if your listeners with any of these tragic diseases will participate in the Sudbury study, we will be able to accumulate that solid statistical database that will help us lay to rest the stories concocted by the perpetrators and used to hide the realities that they want to keep from us.
All right, fine. Well, I think that people, if you have any one of the many diseases, and of course, when you're talking about things like certain types of diabetes, something in Korea, of course, there's a genetic component, but not everybody who has all the genes is necessarily going to get the disease. So, I mean, is there anything that will precipitate that? Is that really what you're suggesting, Don?
Yes, it is what will precipitate it. Now, with Huntington's, it is the disease, cystic fibrosis, which has the greatest genetic component. Huntington's, of course, is seated in the putamen regions of the brain, and those regions of the brain are so critical and are so well protected that both parents have to have defective genes before the putamen becomes vulnerable to the mycoplasma. But even if both parents do have the defective gene, and hence the vulnerability is solidly there, the disease itself is caused by a repeating trinucleotide called glutamine, CGA. CGA repeats, 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 until finally, after about 70 or 80 repeats, it kills the cell it's in. It damages that part of the brain and presents as Huntington's.
Well, now, have you actually, has anybody research been done on showing mycoplasma and Huntington's disease?
Well, what our research has demonstrated is, first of all, it's a repeat of glutamine, CGA, which is cysteine, guanine, and adenine. And we know that glutamine is a neurotransmitter called glutamate, which is GGA, a new trinucleotide, guanine, guanine, adenine. And we know that the first guanine is converted to cysteine by the addition of an ammonia ion, and that ion is released when the mycoplasma kills the cell, and the cell dumps its glutamate into the blood and plasma.
But of course, I mean, do we have any proof, though, that that any of these people actually have the mycoplasma infection? Have we found the mycoplasma in any of them?
Well, that's why we're doing our study. We're saying to these people, okay, you've got the two genes which are defective, and you do have the repeat of CGA. Now, do you have the mycoplasmal infection, which is triggering the release of glutamate and its conversion to glutamine? And we can help you find that out if you participate in the Sudbury study. Because if you do have the mycoplasmal infection, there are certain footprints in the snow that that mycoplasma leaves behind. And if you show us that 15 or 16 examples of those footprints, then the chances are very solid, and then they would merit the really scientific test, which we don't make part of our study because it costs too much. But if we can demonstrate that all the other evidence suggests the mycoplasma infection, then the government would be forced to finance a test with polymerase chain reaction to actually physically demonstrate in all of these diseases the presence of the mycoplasma.
All right, fine. Well, we're out of time, Don. I want to thank you so very, very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, and my compliments to your next guest, the missionary to Africa. God bless him and his work. Those African people have been victims of a terrible crime, and just give him my most sincere thanks for his work.
I certainly will. God bless you. Thanks so much, Don.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening has been Don Scott, and always a pleasure to have him. And I think to clarify what he's saying about HIV disease, is HIV is a disease, but there's also a cofactor in the mycoplasma. And I think this is one of the most interesting things that's been come up with. Certainly Dr. Lowe has pointed this out, that almost all people who have the HIV or AIDS syndrome have not only the AIDS, HIV virus, they also have a mycoplasma, and nobody wants to talk about that. I wonder why. Well, there are lots more to this story, but we don't have time to get into it. This is the time we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, our April newsletter actually goes into the background of the AIDS epidemic and the genocidal policies which are being carried out throughout the world today. If you'd like a free copy of our April newsletter, please give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers. Pray for revival in this great nation, this once great nation under God. And finally, please remember to pray for our ministry of Radio Liberty. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us one of my favorite guests, and we try to get him every time he comes to the United States. His name is Peter Hammond. He's with Frontline Ministries, and of course it goes all over Africa and keeps us abreast of what's happening in that tragic, tragic continent. Peter, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
How long would you be here in the United States?
Well, in fact, I'm getting towards the last spell. I've been here for 2 weeks, and I'll be here for just under a week more.
All right, fine. And so, well, we'll certainly want to give you the opportunity to get out your address in case people would like to be in touch with your ministry. But why don't you just tell us, let's just start with South Africa. What's happening to South Africa? I know you're living there now. You were born in Rhodesia, but you're living in South Africa. How stable is the government? How's the economy doing? What's the state of the law and order and things of that sort?
Well, certainly South Africa's still the richest and most productive country in the continent of Africa, and there's a lot of good things that we could point out in our country. We've got very dynamic church in South Africa. We just had on the 1st of May a strong national day of prayer going throughout the country. In fact, there was something in the region of 6 million Christians gathered in South Africa and neighboring countries for prayer in major places such as football stadiums. In Cape Town, we had about 50,000 people just in one football stadium, and it was specifically for National Day of Prayer and Repentance. So this was very positive. Here we've got, in fact, Frontline Fellowship had the joy of helping to draft the repentance prayer, which was prayed aloud by all these people together. Many positive things like that. However, we've also got to look at the negatives, because the crime and lawlessness under the ANC has been absolutely colossal. And we've had something in the region of 250,000 people murdered in South Africa under the ANC in the last 10 years.
250,000 people murdered?
We're talking about an average of 25,000 a year, a quarter of a million in the last 10 years under the ANC. So, I mean, when you think of the death toll from the war, in 30 years of war between the ANC and the South African government, you know, the apartheid wars, which includes, if I included the terrorists killed, the people killed by the terrorists, soldiers who died in combat, civilians, everyone, in 30 years of war, 34 years of war, 18,000 died on all sides. But every year under the ANC, now that we have peace, we have 25,000 being murdered. But they don't call that terrorism. They don't call it political. They just call it crime. But amongst that includes hundreds of farmers. We've had over 800 farmers, white farmers in South Africa, murdered since the ANC took over. Now, that's not called political. And yet sometimes they catch these terrorists who have been attacking some of the farms, or the farmer himself shoots the assailant, and they find out, oh, this man is a captain or a major in the South African National Defense Force, and he used to be an ANC terrorist, and you know, he's one of the affirmative action people incorporated in the army, and he's got an issued AK-47 or R4 rifle, and it's legal, and oh, how did this happen? And nothing more is done. Or there's bombings in Cape Town, and the police caught the people and had to set them free because the bombers turned out to be National Intelligence Service, in other words, government agents.
Government agents are doing bombing?
Yes, we've had a lot of bombings in Cape Town, and the only people ever caught by the Cape Town police have always been National Intelligence Service people. So we've got some very strange things going on in the country where it looks like the government itself is destabilizing the country, or at least is not prosecuting the people who are destabilizing the country.
Well, I think that's a very interesting thing. In other words, the government is actually creating acts of violence that they're going to be blame on somebody else, maybe on the whites or the radical right, something of the sort. But they are the ones who are actually perpetrating the acts of violence, just as we saw, for instance, here during the civil rights the time when the FBI was infiltrated the Black Panthers and other organizations and committing acts of violence and terrorism to convince everybody it was the wicked communists that were, of course, attacking America.
Yes, well, this is certainly what we've seen. I mean, a government that comes to power through violence can be expected to stay in power through violence and deception. And the most disturbing thing going on in South Africa right now is that the South African government is supportive of the Zimbabwe government, of Robert Mugabe. And as you know, he is involved in lawlessness, racist attacks against white farmers, stealing of farms wholesale, thousands of farms being taken over, and absolutely devastation on the highest scale seen in the continent, where we've got a national suicide going on in Zimbabwe. It's state-sponsored lawlessness, state-sponsored terrorism, and the South African government is supporting this man. Now, that is one of the most foolish things we can do economically, because our rand has devalued to about half of the value it was before the Zimbabwe debacle began.
Now, of course, it used to be, I remember when I lived in South Africa, it was about $1, about $1.20 you'd buy a South African rand. And what's happened to the rand today?
You're quite right. I remember when the South African rand was stronger than the US dollar, but now it's closer to 10 rand to the dollar.
And so it's lost over 90% of its value. And of course,
absolutely.
And of course, in Zimbabwe, it's just total chaos there, isn't it?
It is. In fact, when I was a boy in Rhodesia, I remember when one Rhodesian dollar could buy three American dollars, when the Rhodesian dollar was three times stronger than the American dollar in the mid-70s. And today, it takes 2,000 Zimbabwe dollars to buy one American dollar. In other words, the Rhodesian dollar has gone now down where it is 1/6,000th of its previous value.
But you know, Peter, I think most Americans have forgotten that it was American foreign policy. It was Henry Kissinger, and of course, who was the Secretary of State under the Nixon regime, and then under the Ford regime, who actually forced the Rhodesians to accept Mugabe, a Marxist dictator, who was, of course, won with a phony election that we supervised. So we brought Mugabe, who we knew was a communist, to power, but we also brought Nelson Mandela, who's a lifelong Marxist, to power in South Africa. We overthrew a friendly government and replaced it with a Marxist government in South Africa. We did exactly the same thing in Rhodesia, and most Americans don't really understand that, do they?
No, they don't. In fact, when the United States suffered the terrible terrorist attack on September 11th, 2001, I wrote in response to that the Uprooting Terrorism article, where I said that if the United States president is serious about wanting to deal with the supporters and sponsors of terrorism the same as with the terrorists, then he must give good attention to his own State Department, because they have put terrorists in power in countries like Zimbabwe. And also that he must give attention to the United Nations and the World Council of Churches, who have also financed and supported terrorists worldwide, especially in the ANC in South Africa, the PAC, the same terrorists who attacked the St. James Church, our church, SWAPO in Namibia, the Angolan MPLA, the Frelimo in Mozambique, ZANU in ZAPU in Zimbabwe, all these Marxist revolutionary groups that burned churches, murdered missionaries, shot down civilian airliners, cooked and ate the survivors, planted landmines in farm roads, put car bombs in public streets. Those terrorists were financed and supported by the World Council of Churches, the United Nations, and they were aided by the State Department.
Well, of course, most Americans never stop and realize, of course, a way back, of course, the Al-Qaeda component that was in Bosnia, way back, the Al-Qaeda component that was in Kosovo, way back, the Al-Qaeda component in Chechnya, and yet we say, boy, these terrible terrorists, these Al-Qaeda, boy, they're enemy, and anybody who supports these Al-Qaeda terrorists, we're going to, of course, bring to task. And yet we've been supporting them all along in many parts of the world. And in fact, you commented, and we'll get to that in just a few minutes, that Al-Qaeda is operating in Nigeria, funded, of course, at least in part by our good friends, the Saudis. And, of course, we're allowing the Saudis to continue financing Al-Qaeda all throughout the world. So there's something wrong with this picture, very wrong with the picture. Well, let's go from South Africa. Is the economy doing fairly well there? You mentioned it's the strongest economy in Africa, but you know, when you look at the rest of Africa, that's not much of a statement. Is the economy growing? Is industry coming in? Is there enough stability that the great industrial concerns that pulled out have come back again?
No, many of those who pulled out have never come back again. In fact, quite a few South African companies have moved out too. For example, Old Mutual and Anglo American have both sold off to a British and other shareholders and concerns and have basically left. So the old South African shareholders of South African companies like Old Mutual and Anglo American have left the country. I mean, we've even had chairman of the board of these major South African institutions fleeing the country because of the tremendous crime rate. And the situation in South Africa was summed up by the opposition party, the Democratic Party in South Africa, that the ANC have cost us about 4 million jobs. In other words, since they came to power, they have lost a net 4 million jobs for the country. Even our population has increased, the war and sanctions have ended, yet the economy has shrunk in real terms.
Well, now, what's happened to the lot of the black man there? Certainly, we justified bringing Nelson Mandela to power, you know, because we wanted to help the blacks of South Africa and stop the racial discrimination. Is the black man better off today, or is he worse off today?
I'm afraid most of the black men in South Africa are much worse off because there's greater unemployment, greater crime, far higher disease, AIDS rates, and everything else that you can consider that's negative. Some black people have benefited. Most of those who are on the government gravy train. So those who are part of the ANC's government gravy train, they're doing very well. They might be living in tremendous opulence. But the average black man has suffered immensely. And many, of course, have been murdered. When we talk about 250,000 people being murdered, the vast majority of those people murdered have been black people.
All right, fine. Well, what's happening to the AIDS epidemic in Africa, in South Africa?
The AIDS epidemic is absolutely colossal. I saw government statistics, official statistics before I left, that they are now saying about one in every three South Africans is HIV positive.
Now, of course, is that one in three blacks, or is that overall? Do they separate black and white?
That's correct. Most of the people who have AIDS are black people in South Africa, but it's now officially one in three people total would have AIDS. It's considered to be the worst in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, around which are the two most populated places. In Zimbabwe, they believe that it could be up to 40%.
Okay.
There's only one country in Africa which has got a success story in AIDS, and that is Uganda. Uganda seems to have been able to reverse it. Now, they've got a government that's got one policy, and that is the policy is abstinence before marriage, and it is faithfulness within marriage. And they have done exceedingly well, and that's the only country I know of in Africa that have reversed the AIDS crisis and actually brought it down to much, much lower than anywhere else on the continent.
Well, now, what about what's happening in Botswana? I don't know. Do you get into Botswana at all?
We only drive through on occasion. Botswana seems more stable than most because it's heterogeneous. There's only one ethnic group, which is the Tswana group there. It's stable, the economy is not too bad, although they've also suffered the effects of the Zimbabweans. Enormous amount of Zimbabwean refugees are fleeing into the country, and that's destabilizing them somewhat. But nevertheless, Botswana's economy is better than most, and their pula is worth more than the South African rand at the moment. Petrol is even cheaper in Botswana. But also they're very much in the hands of the Anglo-American internationalist type company.
All right, fine. Now, of course, let's get into Zimbabwe. What's happening in Zimbabwe, the former Rhodesia, where, of course, we have Mugabe, the Marxist dictator that the United States installed there for all intents and purposes. My understanding is he is just really a totally totalitarian a dictator. The blacks are suffering terribly. The whites are losing their farms. And instead, of course, redistributing the farms to the blacks, as he promised, he's giving them to his confreres, to his sister, to his henchmen. Is that true?
That's absolutely correct. What we've got in Zimbabwe at the moment is lawlessness in a very high degree. The government of Zimbabwe has launched this farm invasion primarily to distract attention from their own economic failures, from the complete chaos caused by socialism and their adventurism, because the Zimbabwe army is involved in the war in the Congo immensely. They were involved in the war in Mozambique for many years until that ended in 94, and they've shifted their attention since then to the Congo. They've got at least 11,000 troops in the Congo, and it's costing them over $1 million a day in involvement in just propping up some unpopular, unelected Marxist dictator in the Congo.
Now, it's really a Marxist dictator that they're backing. In other words, another communist dictator in the
correct.
Congo. That's really what that's all about?
It is. And in fact, the Congo is a war to watch, because you've got Angolan troops in there supporting the communists. You've got Congo troops from Congo, Brazzaville, that is. You've got the old French Congo. You've got Central African Republic troops in there. You've got Zimbabwean and Namibian troops from Sam and Jomo are in there, all backing the Marxist Kabila. Amazing that he can't get enough of his own troops in this huge country to back himself. He needs foreign troops to prop him up. And then you've got the Ugandan and Rwandan army who are in there backing the rebels against the Marxists. And that's a good reason for doing it, because both Rwanda and Uganda have suffered Holocaust from the kind of people who are coming from the Congo, and so to protect their own people, they've gone in to support the rebels against these Marxists. So you've got something like 12 countries in Africa all involved in one country's war.
Now, I understand that France is talking about possibly sending troops in. What do you think they would do as far? Would they back the communists, or would they back simply trying to get some sort of representative government going?
We know that the French will back the communists. In fact, the French army in the Rwandan Holocaust, you'll recall, backed the mass murderers who were also Marxist in Rwanda. And I documented that in my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, how the French were accessories before, during, and after the Holocaust in Rwanda. The French armed and trained and equipped the, and even fought alongside with advisors, the Hutu mass murdering governments of the MRND in Rwanda. And when the Holocaust was on the go and it was known, they still resupplied them and continued to aid. And when the Rwandese Patriotic Front, that's the Christian Tutsis, fought back, coming from refugee camps in Uganda and tried to, like little David, stop the big Goliath, in came the French paratroopers in order to create safe zones for the architects of the mass murder, the Hutu mass murderers, to flee to, and they protected them and did a careful withdrawal into Zaire. And then many of the architects of the mass murder of the Christian Tutsis in Rwanda fled to France, where they are still receiving protection. Now, many people say, why would France do this? Well, I've got documented in my book, Holocaust in Rwanda, what the French government said. The foreign minister said, we are holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. In other words, the mass murderers, the Hutus, were French-speaking, and their Christian Tutsi Protestant victims were English-speaking. And so this is a clear case that we back the French speakers.
Well, what a tragic situation that is. And really, when you see France, actually, of course, their leaders are ordinarily pro-communist, and they're dedicated socialists going right along with the terrible, terrible governments that are in Africa today. And the people there, instead of being allowed to solve their own problems, can always depend upon outsiders coming in and complicating them. Well, let's get over into Nigeria, because here is another tragic, tragic country, and especially here because there's about a third of the population are Muslim, two-thirds or close to that are Christian. Is that about right, or is it more?
That's quite correct. Nigeria is the largest nation in Africa. While Sudan's the largest country in terms of size, Nigeria is the largest nation in terms of people, 120 million people and 490 ethnic groups. Now, the three main ethnic groups are the Hausa, who are Muslim, the Yoruba, who are Christian, and the Igbo, who are Christian. Those are the three big ones, but there's a lot of other smaller groups too. Now, the Hausa dominate the whole north, and Nigeria is a federal state, so they've got 36 states, and the 12 northern states have declared Sharia law, Islamic law. And so what you've got in Nigeria is effectively two countries. You've got a Muslim north and you've got a Christian south. Now, in the 43 years of independence, since Britain gave Nigeria independence in 1960, they've been ruled by Muslim dictators for 38 of those years. So they've gone through six violent revolutions, six coup d'etats or military rules, each time by Muslim military dictators. And have only just had their first free elections when, by God's grace, they elected a Christian general and voted down the Muslim candidate. But Nigeria has suffered under Muslim military dictators now for most of its independence. And, of course, they had the terrible Biafran Civil War where millions of Christian Igbos were slaughtered or starved to death by the federal forces. And the worst thing about the Biafran Civil War is that aside from the Soviet Union and with China supporting the Nigerian federal government, so did Britain and the United States and France.
In other words, we supported the same governments that the communists were supporting. Gee, I wonder why.
Well, of course, the Christians, they were just stunned and amazed and couldn't believe why. And I've had a lot of the people ask why, because throughout Africa, the people still have the idea that America stands for freedom and the Soviet bloc stands for tyranny. And so they understand that the U.S., who fought for freedom in Europe and has been ostensibly fighting for freedom in Iraq now, why would they not support freedom when it comes to Christians against Muslims in Nigeria?
All right, fine. Well, what's actually happening there? I understand that in the Christian area, the Muslims have been burning the Christian churches and, of course, killing the Christians. So why don't you tell us about what's happened recently?
Yes, well, Dr. Stan, I was just in Nigeria a few days before coming here to the U.S., and I traveled very widely across the country. Went to four different states and got to the capital and to Lagos and to Jos and Gobokko, and had ministry opportunities all over the country. And I was very impressed by the dynamic Christian churches. No doubt that the church in Nigeria is strong, it's mature, it's growing, it's very evangelistic, and Muslims are coming to Christ in Nigeria. But what's also true is the Muslims are viciously trying to persecute the Christians. There have been literally, without any exaggeration, many hundreds of Christian churches burnt to the ground in Nigeria and thousands of Christians murdered recently.
Now, this is within the last few months?
Yes, we even speak in the last a few months. Let me just give the... In September 2001, when you had the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, Muslim youths were running onto the streets in Jos and Gobokko screaming, Allah Akbar, and they went on a rampage and burned 30 churches and killed 2,000 Christians just in Jos. And down in Gobokko, they destroyed 100 churches in that state. I mean, it's just phenomenal to think of that destruction, because we didn't read about that in any newspapers at the time.
All right, fine. And then, of course, eventually the Christians had to rally and put this down, didn't they?
Yes, they did. In fact, I was most impressed by the resistance of the Christians. And we were told how after the first day and the devastation, the Christians rallied and they realized this is a David versus Goliath. What chance did these poorly armed Christians have against the Muslims, who had been stockpiling weapons and RPGs, AK-47s, which they must have smuggled in great quantities from across the border from the Muslim world, and the Muslims had plainly been preparing for this and stockpiling for months. Well, the Christians only had some spears and clubs and machetes, but they fought, and they fought with such fervor that they captured firearms from the Arabs, and they started to use them. And then a huge truck, an 18-wheeler truck filled with AK-47s, crashed coming into town and spilled, and its contents were revealed, and the Christians realized these were weapons coming for the Arabs. And they took the weapons and started to use them for their defense. In fact, we were told in Jos, the Christians succeeded in killing about 6,000 Muslims and forcing the rest to flee out of the city. So in Jos, all that started with a tremendous defeat for the Christians. By the second, third days, the Christians had rallied, and by God's intervention, by that truck overturning and crashing in the Christian hands, meant that they got a resupply of weapons that they hadn't expected. And so this happened quite a few places where the Christians fought back. We heard that the Muslims were saying, we never thought the Christians would fight back, and they were so amazed. They thought they were going to clear the Christians out of the central states and extend Islamic influence further south and make plateau states and others in the center also under Sharia law. And when the Christians realized they're fighting for their lives, they fought back. The other thing that's very interesting, Dr. Stan, is during all of this violence, the Nigerian army and police stayed in their barracks and did nothing. So the people were at their own, on their own devices. And what came to mind is how the U.S. and British forces in Iraq right now are disarming civilians in Iraq. They are trying to take weapons out of the hands of Iraqis. I think that's very immoral, considering the British and Americans are going to go home. Who's going to protect these Iraqis in this very lawless, dangerous neighborhood if you're going to disarm civilians?
Well, of course, now, you commented when we talked before that we see the hand of Saudi Arabia here promoting this radical form of Islam, this Wahhabism, which, of course, is against Muslims. And, you know, it's as violently against the infidels, the Christians and Jews. In fact, it's really against any Muslim that doesn't go along with its form of radicalism. And you mentioned that Saudi Arabia is building the mosques and promoting that.
Oh, yes. In fact, I saw evidence all over Nigeria. I've seen it also in Zambia, in Malawi as well, where Middle Eastern oil money, mainly from Saudi Arabia, it's mostly the Wahhabi side of Islam, they're building lots of mosques. We're talking about opulent mosques. And the capital city of Nigeria, in Abuja, saw this grand mosque. It's got gold-plated dome, literal gold-plated dome, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of mosque that's been constructed there. And all over the country, you just see the heavy hand of oil money from the Middle East, which is trying to promote radical Islam, including madrasas, Muslim schools. And they are trying to encourage Christians to send their children to the Muslim schools for free education.
Well, of course, there's nothing, there's no free education, there's free indoctrination. Now, what about Al-Qaeda? Is there an Al-Qaeda component there in Nigeria?
Yes, definitely, Dr. Stan. I was shown several factories which they said, this is owned by Al-Qaeda and this is an Al-Qaeda front. And the Muslim connections are well known. In fact, as is typical, the Muslims dominate a lot of the market and enormous amounts of the industries in the country. And that would also be a holdover from the days when they had Muslim military dictators ruling Nigeria, and they saw that these radical elements were able to diversify and have commercial interests there, which no doubt is part of their huge money laundering operation. But yes, we saw NASCO, for example, as one of the companies. I was shown in Jos, which was a known Al-Qaeda front.
So that we then find Saudi Arabia financing a lot of Al-Qaeda activity. And, of course, we're just not reading about this in the United States. And what is Nigeria, what, 125, 150 million people?
Yes, that's right. The census in the year 2000 was 120 million. So it would be closer to 130, 134 million right now. And I've been quite struck by that. Saudi Arabia is heavily involved in financing some of the radical Islamicist activities throughout the Middle East and throughout West Africa, North Africa. We've seen that in Zambia and in Nigeria. So Saudi Arabia is promoting a radical form of Islam and is aggressively supporting Islamicist regimes who are, through Sharia law, persecuting Christians. I don't actually see how Saudi Arabia can be an American ally.
Well, of course, there are many, many strange things going on in the world. We're going to be back in just a moment after we take this break.
Mm-hmm.
with your organization, and if they'd like to know more about your ministry and about getting your books.
Yes, thank you. We would love to be able to provide folks with information and ammunition that they can use in this. We've got documentation hand, and if folks want a free copy of frontline newsletters such as on what's going on in Zambia, Zimbabwe, or Nigeria, they just need to phone 1-888-918-4100. So that's 1-888-918-4100, and that's a toll-free number in Arizona. Or they can look at our website. It's www.frontline.org.za. So it's frontline, F-R-O-N-T-L-I-N-E, .org.za.
All right, fine. And I'm looking forward to getting your regular email, weekly updates on what's going on over there in Africa. So we're going to let our listeners understand what's going on, because we're certainly going to get the truth out of most of our controlled media. So, they'll focus our attention on SARS, and certainly SARS is a problem. 500 people have died throughout the world. But, of course, they can kill 250,000 people in South Africa, not even mention it. There can be the massive slaughters there, certainly in Nigeria. No mention of that at all, or the involvement of Saudi Arabia, our good friends, who have been financing Al-Qaeda both before and after September 11th. But, of course, we wouldn't want to tell the American people that. We might wonder why we're going to war with Iraq. When, of course, they weren't involved at all with financing or the terrorists. In fact, as everyone will remember, 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. So we went to a war with Iraq, and Osama bin Laden and many of his top followers came from Saudi Arabia. So we went to war with Iraq. So we go to war with Afghanistan, we go to a war with Iraq. And the American people never stop and ask, what's really going on? Well, let's get back to, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about Nigeria? You say that the church there, the Christian church, is really having an impact, but why isn't the Christian government there doing anything to protect the Christians?
Well, I wouldn't call a government that they have in Nigeria Christian. They've had a Muslim military dictatorship for most of the four decades they've had of independence. They do have a Christian a general who seized power after the death of the Muslim dictator Abaka. And this man had come to Christ in prison, and he was a general, and he seized power, and he's got a very credible Christian testimony. General Abasanji is now the president. But after seizing power from the Muslims, he then went to a national election, and it's the very first free election the country had ever had, and the Muslim candidate lost, and Obasanjo won. Now, I wouldn't call Nigeria a Christian country, even though they've got a Christian majority of the population, but the people have no experience and have had no opportunity to influence the government before, let alone to apply biblical principles into government. So there's a long way to go in Nigeria, but the thing that's so distressing is that when the people were under attack and being butchered in the streets, their army and their police did not come to their protection, which just shows the fact that you cannot depend on governments to protect you at all. It's just not an option in those situations. So in Nigeria, we need to go a long way still to setting up a truly Christian state.
Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if they could adopt the principles that we had at one time here in the United States? Of course, we're abandoning those Christian principles that once made America the envy of the world. Well, let's get over into Angola. Certainly, supposedly, Jonas Savimbi has been killed. And, of course, now the Marxists are in complete and total control, financed, of course, by Chevron, money from Chevron Oil, as they always have been, and supported by the communists. What's happening in Angola? What's happening to the Christian element there?
I feel really terrible about what's happened in Nigeria, in Angola, because I've spent quite a bit of time in there myself, and I know many of those people. We knew Jonas Savimbi and his people. In fact, his vice president, Jeremiah Chatunda, was murdered. He was shot dead while under UN protection during the first elections, which the UN so-called supervised. What you've got in Angola are people who are allies of America and allies of South Africa, too, who fought very bravely and hard, as you know, against the Marxists and with great success. and on several occasions have come so close to liberating Angola, and they've been betrayed in each case. And one of the people I know in the South African Army, he took a South African unit all the way up to Luanda. They defeated the Cubans. They were right at the gates of Luanda. They could see the Cuban troops loading their tanks onto the ships and loading to go back to Cuba. They'd left. They were fleeing the country. And at that point, the U.S. had that terrible betrayal after the American government had asked South Africa to get involved to fight against the Marxists there. Kissinger himself had got them involved. When it came to the UN Security Council vote, the U.S. voted against South Africa being involved there and condemned them. And at that point, they withdrew. That was 1975. There have been many betrayals since. And these poor Angolans, these Ovumbundu tribesmen of Jonas Mbembe, they fought so hard, they fought so well, and they've had so many ups and downs, and now their leader was betrayed. You are aware that Jonas Mbembe was assassinated by, we were informed, a Spetsnaz group. They were able to track his position from a satellite phone, and in came a Russian Special Forces unit, Spetsnaz. I suppose they felt they had some old scores to settle, and he was assassinated.
By communists. No, I'd never heard that. We heard he died. We didn't realize it was a communist hit team.
That's right. Russian special forces came in and did it. And of course, they needed the superpower help just to even locate him through a satellite phone. Only America or Russia, I think, could do that.
No, of course, we've given Russia the technology. We finance Russia at every turn. And, of course, what people don't understand is our government and certainly Chevron have been helping the communist Marxist government there, oppress the people. Chevron Oil, Standard Oil, in fact, there used to be a tanker that went in and out of Angola. It was called the Condoleezza Rice because Condoleezza was on the board of Chevron Company. They changed his name when she became, of course, our national security advisor.
Goodness me, I did not know that. I'm astounded at conflicts of interest that abound all over. And I thought that such things were not wise for anyone involved in public office to have such an obvious conflict of interest.
Well, of course, as long as nobody knows about the conflicts of interest, it's perfectly all right. It's like Richard Perle, who was chairman of the Defense Advisory Board, was also, of course, giving all sorts of advice to people how to play the stock market, and yet he was in charge of this organization within the Defense Department that was directing the purchase, and then, of course, advising people which stocks to buy. And it wasn't until a man named Seymour Hersh wrote an article in the New Yorker magazine entitled Lunch with the Chairman, and he was talking about Richard Perle, that anybody found out that Richard Perle was selling his advice, and making a lot of money, and he was going to get $600,000 if he could talk the government into allowing Global Crossing to sell all their telephone connections to the Chinese communists. And, well, of course, he resigned his position as chairman. He's still on the board. But everything is corruption. And fortunately, Peter, we've lost our moral compass. And, of course, thank goodness we have a few honest reporters like Seymour Hersh. And we have the New Yorker of all magazines publishing things that will bring the truth out. You're certainly never going to read in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal.
It's exceedingly disturbing. Of all the different political figures that I've met over the years, there's only one that I can think of as a man of honor and integrity, and that was Ian Smith of Rhodesia. There's a man who said very well, we were never beaten by our enemies, we were betrayed by our friends.
That was Henry Kissinger, of course, who went down and made all sorts of promises to the Rhodesians and to Ian Smith, and he was simply lying. Anybody with an ounce of intelligence would ever believe a word that Henry Kissinger said? I don't know.
Well,
but, of course, he's so convincing.
That's true. But Ian Smith, to this day, still feels that Henry Kissinger was having his best interest at heart and was trying to negotiate the best deal, because Ian Smith is an honorable man who cannot understand people who are dishonest. He is not, there's no deceit in him, there's no guile in him.
Well, let me suggest that you get the book, The Final Days, page 194, Woodward Bernstein's story of the end of the Nixon administration, where Henry Kissinger is talking to some of his advisors and saying, There is no honor in what we're doing. You have to use lies and treachery. Don't think I'm an honest man because I'm not. And then he talked about, you know, how our soldiers are stupid dumb animals to be used for political purposes. American soldiers are stupid dumb animals. Page 194, The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein. But he had said quite openly, this is a nasty business. This is not an honest or honorable business we're in. You know, of course, you lie, and you've got to learn to do the same thing. And that's, in essence, exactly what he said.
That is absolutely despicable and horrific.
And, of course, he betrayed the people of Rhodesia. He betrayed the people of South Africa. He betrayed the people of Chile. He betrayed the people of Guatemala. And he's in the process of betraying the American people. And I think it's very pointed and very important that we stop and realize that when our Christian president was going to pick a chairman for the new government intelligence committee to investigate 9/11, who should he pick out of the entire country? As Henry Kissinger. I really feel terribly bad that George Bush doesn't understand what Henry Kissinger advocates. In fact, Henry Kissinger really is very wary traveling outside the United States because so many people have advocated he be arrested and tried for his war crimes.
Well, indeed. Rhodesia was an absolute paradise before the Marxists took over. We had the lowest crime rates, the lowest unemployment in the world. I remember being brought up there where there were no keys, locks, little bars over the doors or windows. Things were open. Keys were kept in ignition of the car, even downtown. It was a country without fear and without crime.
Yeah, well, what about the relationship between the black and the white?
And the relationships between them was excellent before the revolutions that were inspired from outside. It's incredible that Britain could have given independence to a cannibal like running Kenya, Kenyatta, could have been handed over. He is the head of the Mau Mau, and he had taken part in cannibalistic rituals. He could be handed over Kenya. You could have President for Life, Hastings Banda, getting Nyasaland, which became Malawi. You could have a Marxist like Kenneth Kaunda being given Zambia. But when it came to Rhodesia, which had provided more soldiers percentage to its male population any other part of the British Empire in both the First and Second World War and the Malayan conflict, when it came to Rhodesia, no, they were not fit to rule themselves. And yet the Rhodesians had never needed one pence of British money. It had always been self-supporting, self-defending. Not one British soldier, not one British a pound had ever come to Rhodesia. Rhodesia supported the crown, but it never needed support. It was a self-supporting, self-governing dominion of the British Empire. And so when Britain was giving independence to all these other countries that plainly weren't prepared, Rhodesians said, well, why can't we have independence? And they of course, declared unilateral declaration of independence. And at that point, that's when the United States State Department, the British Commonwealth, the Organization of African Unity, the World Council Church of the UN, ganged up to try to destroy this little country. And it's an extraordinary thing, but I think as people fling up their hands in horror and say, how can Mugabe do what he's doing? They need to ask, how did he get there? And, of course, it was State Department policy that put him there. As you said, Kissinger and Andrew Young, and let's be fair, he also had his part straight after Kissinger got the ball rolling. And under Carter's administration, Rhodesia was betrayed and handed over to Marxist revolutionaries. And to this day, we have got one of the worst mass murdering thugs running and ruining what was one of the finest allies of America. Here you've got another case of an ally betrayed.
Well, it's sort of like when we betrayed the Shah of Iran and brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. They knew exactly what they were doing, creating, of course, the best enemy the money could buy. We betrayed our friends. We, of course, aid our allies. And then we wonder why we're in the mess we are today. Well, let's get up into the Sudan. I know you've been into the Sudan. And what's happening there?
Well, we've got a team there right now. There is a ceasefire in Sudan at this moment through tremendous pressure from the U.S. State Department, might I add. The government of Sudan is negotiating right now with the Christian Resistance Movement, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. I'm always a bit disturbed when the Arabs talk peace. Basically, what's happened is that the Muslims have lost the war. They haven't had a troop on the ground in Western Equatoria, for example, where we have our base, since 1997.
Well, then why is our government demanding a ceasefire if the Arabs are losing the war, or is it like we did in China when the communists there were losing the war, and we insisted on a ceasefire so the communists could regroup, and of course we could cut off all support to the anti-communists in China, to Chiang Kai-shek?
This is what we are afraid of, is a repeat of that kind of scenario, because the government of Sudan has been blowing up the bridges. That's one of our biggest problems. They're blowing up bridges. When a government starts to blow up its own bridges, it's no longer a government. When it destroys its own infrastructure, the only presence that the National Islamic Front government has had in Western Equatoria, where we have had our mission base, is by aerial bombardments. They haven't had a troop on the ground. All they've been able to do is come over by air and bomb, terror bombings on civilian centers, hospitals, schools, churches, including the frontline fellowship mission base has been bombed 10 times. I've had several services where I've been preaching, even on Sunday morning, been bombed by Governor Sudan Air Force.
But now, Chris, I thought it was the Chinese petrol using the money, of course, they'd raised here in the United States, that was financing the government of the Sudan.
That's correct. The China Petroleum, they are exploiting the oil of Sudan, and they are enabling them to buy lots of these weapons. The weapons they buy are from China, too. So China is, of course, getting benefited from this in several different ways. Also, there's been a certain amount of aid that's come from Malaysia, from Indonesia, and Iran, I might add. All of them have given a tremendous amount of aid to this terrorist sponsoring government. And people must remember that Al-Qaeda started in Sudan.
Now, what is the United States doing today to embargo Sudan, to put pressure on it, so that it would just stop doing what is it, killing the Christians?
Yes, that's exactly it. They have got an anti-Christian policy. The government of Sudan's policy is Arabization and Islamization. They want everyone to speak Arabic, and they want everyone to become a Muslim. That's why they're bombing schools that are Christian or are any schools that are not Muslim. And their policy is scorched earth, or they call it tamsit, homing in the mountains. The vast majority of the churches, schools, hospitals in the Liver Mountains, their crops have been put to the torch, burnt. There have even been hundreds of Christian men crucified in the Liver Mountains. So when you think of the incredible atrocities of the government of Sudan, it makes it incomprehensible that the U.S. State Department has just in the last week suspended sanctions on Sudan. And I don't know if your listeners are aware of it, but there's been no discussion. It just has been dropped. They've dropped the sanctions.
So we've lifted the sanctions on, we had sanctions on Sudan, now we've lifted them so they can then continue their persecution of the Christian element?
That's correct, and there's not an official peace treaty yet. All there is a ceasefire, and they're discussing a possible peace treaty.
Well, I think it's very interesting. Of course, China Petro is one of the major financiers of this. And who owns China Petro? Well, Warren Buffett is one of the major investors in China Petro. He's just bought another 9% or more. He's already had a lot of money invested there. Why is Warren Buffett financing a country that is financing the Sudan that is killing Christians? This is Berkshire Hathaway, one of the fabled stocks here in the United States. What's wrong with this scenario?
It doesn't make sense from the perspective of what is being given over in the public media, that is for sure. But certainly the Christian forces have won the war on the ground, and while they're still suffering a lot from aerial attacks from the government of Sudan, I'd say the government of Sudan is the only one who can benefit from these peace talks, because in the ceasefire they have a chance to recover, and the SPLA has only gained territory in the last 7 years. They haven't lost any territory in 7 years. The government of Sudan hasn't gained any territory and only lost in the last 7 years. So the ceasefire at this moment, unfortunately, I think, serves the cause of the government of Sudan rather than the Freedom Fighters.
Well, now, what about the supplying of the Christian element there? Where are they getting their weapons? Where are they getting the food for their people? Because, of course, any time the Muslims have come in there, they've done everything they could to destroy the food supply and ready to impoverish the people.
That's correct. The only support that the SPLA has received over the years that I know of is a bit from Eritrea, and that's more to retaliate for the Sudan government's support of subversive elements in Eritrea. So this is a kind of tit for tat.
Well, what about the American government? We're spending an awful lot of money in Africa, and of course we're talking about spending $100 or a couple hundred billion in Iraq. Is the American government giving any aid to the Christians in the Sudan?
Not that I'm aware of at all. In fact, while I heard of some support that was meant to have been voted in before, the SPLA troops are still walking around barefoot.
Now, what about the United Nations, of course, this great paragon of virtue that, of course, is so interested in helping people?
No, well, the United Nations is most certainly not supporting any of the freedom fighters or Christians in the south of Sudan. The United Nations is helping prolong the war by flying food and aid to the government of Sudan garrisons in the south.
Now, I understood that the United Nations had put a ban on taking Bibles into the south.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, Dr. Stan. I've had every flight I've ever planned to take into Sudan cancelled by the United Nations. In fact, the first time this happened, I went along to the security officer of the United Nations. He is a British SAS chap, and I spoke to him, and he's all very friendly, and I explained that his chaps had cancelled my flight approval, and could he do something about it? He said, absolutely. And he got his pen out, and he was about to give the authorization. He said, what's your cargo? And I said, Bibles. At this point, he put the pen away, folded, closed the book, leaned back and said, there's 14 helicopter gunships stationed in Juba. They'll blow you out of the sky. I said, I know, that's why I need authorization. And he said, with Bibles, you'll never get it. If you take off with Bibles, we'll blow you out of the sky.
We will blow you out, meaning the British authorities or the United Nations with British help and authorization.
That's right. He would inform the government of Sudan that they would blow us out of the sky, but he literally used the terms, we will blow you out of the sky, in the second threat. And I've come across in so many different ways how the United Nations have shown their incredible hostility to the church. Now, we found a few good people on the ground, you know, the odd pilot here and there who's actually helped us practically, but the UN officials who make the decision, middle and upper echelon, are uniformly anti-Christian. And I think it was very well put by one of the Sudanese ministers who said, the UN is not against religion, they're only against Christianity.
And I think that's really so important for our listeners to understand that there is this eternal battle, this anti-Christian battle, which is one reason why I know that the Christianity is true, because all the forces of darkness in the United Nations and all the world is certainly turned against it, wants to destroy it in any way they can. People don't understand that, but of course even what's going on in the administration here in America today, this whole idea of faith-based programs, you know, this is an effort to make the church dependent upon the state so it can be destroyed, and the ministers that go along with that will be silenced and neutralized in their efforts to preach the gospel. So there is really a conspiracy against God today. And it seems to be on the winning side. Of course, you and I know that in the final analysis it will not be, but right now they hold the positions of power, not only in the United Nations, but many times right here in our own government.
Yes, that's so. But there's a few things that they must be frustrated about. I'm sure that the UN must be extremely frustrated at the tremendous resilience and growth of the Christian church in Africa in particular, and of course of the homeschooling movement and independent Christian radio stations that you have in the USA. There's those who are not buying the party line and who find their meaning in the Holy Scriptures and in the Lord Jesus and have no faith in governments or super governments. And this must frustrate them that there are still, no matter what they do, the people who will not bow the knee to Baal and who put Jesus as Lord, and they will not accept anything else. And in Africa, I see this certainly in Nigeria, Zambia, in South Africa, in Sudan. There is a tenacity and a determination to be faithful to the Lord and a complete lack of trust in governments or the United Nations.
Well, I'd like to just touch very briefly on Zambia, because this is another area with an extremely high AIDS rate. And now, of course, there was a gentleman there. He was the president for, I don't know, 4 or 8 years, who professed to be a Christian. Now we're hearing all sorts of stories about his corruption and stealing money. Is this true, or is this simply an effort to discredit him?
I think it most certainly could be true, because as an individual, yes, he seems to have fallen in his second term in office. His first term in office, he did very well. And we're talking about Frederick Chalubi here. But in the second term of office, the advisors around him really turned him into a unwise and corrupt way. Now, there's no doubt Zambia today is better than it ever was before, under Kaunda. But many of Kaunda's advisors saw the writing on the wall and swapped sides, crossed the floor, and joined the opposition. And Chalubi trusted them, and they were more experienced. And many of these old UNIP cabinet ministers of Kaunda, who had the money, the experience, the context, they're the ones who corrupted this man. And I think it should be a warning to Christians that going into politics, you've got to be very alert. And I think this Chalubi was, after a very good beginning, he ended badly.
And that's such a shame. Well, I think that, as you say, you know, you should never be unequally yoked, and you cannot, you know, you can may talk to people on the other side, but never join with them, because they know exactly what they're doing, and so many Christians are so trusting. Well, we're just about out of time, Peter. Let's, of course, get out that telephone number one more time, and then we'll get your parting thoughts.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Stan. If anyone wants to get hold of our book, Holocaust in Rwanda, or in the Killing Fields of Mozambique, or Faith on the Fine Sudan, or the video, Sudan, the Hidden Holocaust, they can buy them from ITMI, our sister mission based here in Arizona. The phone number is 1-888-918-4100. That's 1-888-918-4100. Or check our website at www.frontline.org.za. If you want to send us an email, do info@frontline.org.za.
Is that Z-A?
That's Z-A.
Right, okay.
And we will gladly send you our newsletters free. Our hard copy newsletters come by snail mail once a quarter. Or if they want to get on e-updates, we'll send e-updates roughly every week or two.
All right, fine. And I hope you got my number there. We talked about that before. Well, I want to thank you so very much for everything you're doing. And of course, anytime you're here in the United States, please give me a call, and we'll try to get you on as many radio stations as we can.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan. And God bless all your listeners. You must fight to keep America free, because the rest of the world will be counting on you, too.
God bless you. Thank you. Good night, Peter.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Peter Hammond, and I hope you enjoyed the program. Certainly, Peter is on the front lines of this battle, and he's out there going all throughout Africa, many times at great risk to his life, going into Sudan and Angola, and, of course, many of these places, Nigeria, where Christian missionaries are not very, very popular. He's on the front line, and certainly deserves your help and your prayer. And hope you've enjoyed this hour. And no calls, we just first got a chance to get an overview of what's going on in Africa. A tragic, tragic story. And if you would like a free copy of my latest newsletter, which talks about the AIDS epidemic in Africa, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Pray for America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.